everybody at some point in their lives will have caring responsibility and will be cared for, we hope, or not in some cases. So we see care as absolutely fundamental. I need to tell you of upcoming events before we start. The format will be things, so we'll begin with 20 minutes, some specific questions, followed by Mary, 20 minutes, some specific questions, and then we'll open out. We will then move building, if people are interested. We will, at 2:15, we will reconvene, the Atlantic Fellows, welcome. We will reconvene to a building, R505 in Lincoln Inn Fields, where we will carry on with some of the discussion and talk about how we want to develop the care theme. We have got lots of ideas, we've got lots of international speakers coming, we've got lots of events planned, we hope to work with the migration group as well. So we want to talk, we want to hear from people what they'd like to do and how we develop that. So there's quite a lot in planning and it's feeding back. We've had two meetings so far in the past, but this is like the formalisation of it. So upcoming events I need to tell you about. Looking at labour markets from a multi-dimensional perspective, the quality of employment in South America. It's a public event on Tuesday the 19th of November with our very own Professor Kirsten Senbruch, who's from Chile, who's working on really interesting work on labour markets. With discussant Andreas Velasco, School of Public Policy, and Stephen Manchin from the Economic Performance Centre. Then we have Precarious Refuge, Ethno-Nationalism and the Politics of Housing Refuges, which makes a lot more connection to what we're doing now. And is that organised by you, Suzanne? Yep. And that's with speaker Dr. Ramola Sanyal from Geography. Do you want to say anything? No, that's fine. Okay.
Wednesday next week, yep. For lunch, 1 till 2.
1 till 2. And then a public event again is Thursday the 28th of November, 6:30 in the evening. We'll be Kirsten again with a group of Chileans talking about Chilean unrest, inequality, social conflict and political change. Very opportune at the moment. Nothing else I need to announce?
No.
Okay, great. We will start. Thank you for being patient, Insa.
Yes,
so, Insa from the law department, but is an anthropologist by training, has been doing lots of work, was on the radio recently, if people would like to listen to her. There's been lots of work, doing lots of work from state failure and statecraft. So, thank you, Insa.
Do warn after maybe 15, 18 minutes.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay, well, thank you for coming to listen to my talk. I thought I'd do two things today. One is to speak about my recently published book, which is based on a long-term ethnography, which looks at how continuous processes of state control and state withdrawal have compounded a crisis of social reproduction on a working class council estate where I've been working for the last decade. And that part will, I guess, speak directly to today's theme on who cares in a shrinking welfare state. But then the second thing I want to do is to draw on new fieldwork, which I'm right in the middle of doing, and today is the first time I'm sort of presenting it, so please be generous, but also constructive. And this is fieldwork on what seems, at least on the face of it, to be a contradictory development, which relates the rediscovery of care on the part of the state in the form of its modern slavery agenda. And what this shift has meant is that the same working class people who've been penalized through austerity politics and through much more long-term neoliberal reforms are now being reinvented as potential slaves and as vulnerable victims who are in need of state care and state saving. And what I want to suggest is that while this shift on the face of it constitutes a departure from the kind of more conventional forms of neoliberal statecraft and control as we know it, actually, I think the way I started thinking about it is in terms of a deepening of its punitive logics through particular kinds of techno-moral means. And I'm going to explain some of that in the conclusion. Okay, so this sounds very abstract. Here's what I'm going to do to break it down. I'm going to start by introducing my field site, my ethnography a little bit. Then I'm going to talk a bit about my book and what I mean by legacies of state failure and the sort of crisis of social reproduction. Then in the third part, I'm going to come back to my current research, which is on this idea of the rediscovery of a certain idea of state care in the form of the government's current modern slavery agenda and how it's been applied to so-called counterline cases. And then in the conclusion, I want to ask some questions about how we make sense of this sort of state project and what kinds of analytical questions this raises about care. Okay. So let me start by telling you a little bit about my field site. This is a picture that is reproduced on the cover of my book. It's a painting by the British-born working-class artist George Shaw. I don't know if any of you know him, who sort of draws sceneries from the council estate he grew up on. And this is a picture, I think, of a house he lived in. Now, for those of you who might not know, who might not be British like myself, just to explain briefly, council estates are called council estates because they're housing developments that were built by councils, so local authorities, mostly in the post-war decades, and back then mostly as a form of accommodation for the sort of Fordist industrial working classes. What's been happening since the 1980s, however, with the sort of onset of industrial decline and Thatcherite policies, is that many of these places have been turned into neighbourhoods that today are homes for some of the most dispossessed members of the population. And the community where I've done most of my research really is a typical council estate in that respect. It sort of typifies these developments. You can see a couple of pictures here. It's a neighborhood of over 13,000 people situated on the peripheries of an otherwise very wealthy town in the south of England. The people who live on this estate, mostly a population of white British working class people, but there's always been quite a sized minority of people of African Caribbean descent, and relationships between the two groups run very deep. Were originally tied to a car factory that was in production in the 1950s, 1960s. It's still running today, but it's massively reduced its production. And today, unemployment and welfare dependence run very high. Most people survive through a combination of welfare benefits and sort of employment in the sort of low service sector, kind of on 0-hour contracts, that sort of typical story. Now, I've been working with people on this estate since 2009, when I spent an initial period of 2 years living in the community and working with people that back then, that was part of my PhD project. And over the years, most of my research has been with white MDME mothers who live on the estate, typically women between their 20s and 40s, who've raised children on the estate, and who also typically carry the double burden of having to generate an income for their households, as well as doing the bulk of informal care labour for their children and sometimes elderly and kin at home. Okay, so what am I doing in my ethnography? What am I doing? Well, in the book that was published earlier this year, much of what I'm trying to do is to develop an argument about state failure in contemporary Britain. And what I try to show is how legacies of class-based state control, as well as processes of state withdrawal, that have, I think, always been present in working class communities, but that have definitely been accelerated under the shift to neoliberalism, have compounded a crisis of social reproduction. And what I show in the book is that these processes tend to be narrated by citizens in terms of a strong sense of state failure, so the failure on the part of the state to care for its people, to care for citizens who live in that community. And much of what I'm trying to do in the book is to discuss the implications this has for the way people relate to political citizenship, to politics, to democracy, which I'm not going to go into today because it doesn't really fit the theme of the talk. But I do want to say a few more words about the sort of crisis of social reproduction. So I come here then to the second part of my paper where I outline some of the key points that emerge from the book. So essentially what I'm trying to do in the book is to trace what I call legacies of sort of class-based state control from the post-war moment in Britain to more contemporary forms of neoliberal statecraft. And I start from the premise in the book that the post-war welfare state was probably never fully achieved probably never fully achieved its goal of social justice for all groups. So sort of T.H. Marshall's idea of social rights was only ever imperfectly realized for working class communities, in particular for working class women and immigrants who were living in these communities. But I think it was probably only in the 1980s with the turn to neoliberal policies that these sort of legacies of class-based, gendered and racialized coercion were brought more explicitly to the fore, with shifts like the turn to means-tested welfare systems and the sort of moralization of people who continue to be dependent on welfare. Then in the 1990s and 2000s with the new Labour government's law and order policy that increased massively policing in these communities. And most recently, the shift to austerity politics under Conservative-led governments. And so what I explore in the book ethnographically is how the sort of combined effect of all these different policies has reconfigured state-citizen relations in particular ways. And what I show is that in their day-to-day lives, the people that I worked with, that I lived with, continued to care for each other, for their communities against the odds, and yet they feel that the state continuously fails to reciprocate its own duty of care. So we can see this, for example, in the way in which state withdrawal has furthered material decline in these communities, you know, the physical degeneration of people's homes. Really?
Yeah.
Only have 5 minutes left. And communities. And where the state does remain present, it tends to penalize precisely the areas of social reproduction that are so important to people's lives. And I don't have any time to go into this, but we can see this right across.
You've got 10 minutes left.
Sorry? I do have 10 minutes left. Ah. Okay. you can see this right across the policy spectrum. So, for example, you see this in the way that means-tested welfare policies, which are the kind of standard welfare policies you get today, tend to penalize the actual living arrangements, fluid households that women have by prioritizing the idea of the single welfare claimant, which just doesn't exist really for these people who live in mutually dependent communities. You can see this in the way that law and order policing not only targets specific individuals who are seen to have committed crimes or to act in antisocial ways, but also targets entire family networks and households of these individuals that they're attached to. And you can see this, I think, in the rollout of austerity-based policies, which have literally pushed many people beyond the brink. And so what I talk about in the book is that it is precisely this disjuncture between people's own efforts to be good persons, to care for their community, against the backdrop of the authorities' evident refusal to care and to reciprocate, that results in a very strong sense of state failure. And the book talks a lot about how women try to negotiate that, how they try and resist it, subvert it, personalize it, but how ultimately their options are very limited. And I think that's key to the way people then come to engage with politics and relate to democracy more broadly in Britain today. Now, I don't want to say much more about this because I probably now only have 8 minutes left. What I want to do now is move on to the next part of the presentation, because what's happened basically is since I finished the book and I send it off, I've become aware of quite a different development. Which didn't find its way into my book, but which is happening in Britain today. And that is the sort of idea of a rediscovery of care, an idea of the state needing to step in and provide for its people, which at least on the face of it, I think, challenges some of the narratives of state failure which I've outlined so far. And I think this is what we can see in the rediscovery of modern slavery, which has become one of the sort of government sort of flagship agendas over the last few years. So let me unpack this a little bit. Modern slavery as a concept has been on the British government's agenda since 2015. It was Theresa May's thing, first when she was Home Secretary and then when she became Prime Minister. And I think the language of slavery is actually interesting in itself for a country that's never come to terms with its own history of the Atlantic slave trade, but we can talk about that another time. In terms of the actual policies, what's been happening since 2015 is that the government drafted this whole policy agenda, including legislation, which was meant to address victims of international trafficking, people who are coming in through international borders and who are seen to be exploited, trafficked and enslaved mostly on British grounds. But what's been happening with this policy, in what I think is a really interesting and weird twist, is that over the last 2 or 3 years it's become increasingly domesticated, so it's mostly being used actually today in relation to domestic British working class victims. And the key area where we see this playing out is in relation to county lines. Some of you might have heard of that. That was a documentary which was on Channel 4 last week about Thames Valley Police and how they deal with county line cases. But essentially, county lines is a name that was invented by the police a few years ago to refer to the organisations of Britain's illicit economy of Class A drugs. And it refers to a process whereby big drug dealers from major cities, London, Manchester and Birmingham, I think are the three main hubs, are increasingly spreading out to smaller market and coastal towns in an attempt to make better business. And what's happening from a policy point of view is that it's the foot soldiers of this drugs trade, so those at the bottom of this drugs economy, the runners who carry the drugs between places, who sell the drugs in the streets, who are sometimes kept in so-called trap houses for weeks, who are now being discovered by the government as being modern slaves, as being potentially exploited by others high up in the chain. Now, I first became aware of this whole slavery agenda last year spring when I went back to the estate, and some of the mothers on the estate were beginning to tell me that their children were now being treated as being enslaved. And these are the same families who'd been penalized by austerity rules, by decades of neoliberal control, who were now being recognized by the state as being in need of care and saving. And so this seemed like a strange paradox to me. I couldn't quite make sense of it, and I began to research this. So for the last year or so, I've been spending a lot of time with families, but also in police stations, local authority offices, with defense and prosecution lawyers, and chiefly also in England's criminal courts. Now, what have I found? I think on the face of it, this sort of discovery of slavery and victimhood in the in relation to county lines does seem like a huge step forward. Most obviously, it has resulted in a shift away from prosecuting young people, often for low-level drug dealing offences, towards an approach that explicitly endorses care and safeguarding. And this is often police-led, so the police talk about it as an important ideological cultural shift that is revolutionizing the way they think and the way they act as carers as opposed to kind of law enforcement officials. It has also meant that new forms of welfare support and housing is being extended to families who have been found to be victims of slavery, and which is significant, I think, in a context where the welfare state itself has withdrawn, where austerity politics has been exactly about the opposite. And finally, we've had a sort of new language of moralization, I think, where people who would have previously been seen as part of a sort of criminal underclass, who would have been stigmatized for being scroungers, are now being recognized for their victimhood. And yet, I think this is not the whole story. And I think if we dig deep, and this is really what my ethnographic work is getting at, we can also see that important continuities arise with the sort of legacies of state control that I outlined in the first part of the presentation. And I'm going to whiz through this very quickly because I only have a few minutes left. But essentially, what I think this sort of rediscovery of care on the part of the state is doing is it's really dangerous. It basically means that it renders working class relationships legible in new ways, and it does so through a lens of extraction and exploitation. Okay? So while working class people are no longer recognized as being part of the criminal underclass, what they are being recognized now are in terms of people who are likely to exploit and extract value, economic value from each other. And you can really see this, for example, in this poster, which was published by West Yorkshire Police, which has come up with this weird new legal proxy that the police are using now called mate crime. which refers to a situation where people pretend to be your friends, but really they're there to exploit you. And so, you know, the authorities are being trained to spot bait crime as a way of identifying and reading working class relationships. Similarly, and related to this, I think these sort of new forms of legibility have meant that the state can now monitor and intervene in working class spaces of socializing and livelihood making in kind of stronger ways than it would have before. And I don't know if any of you saw this summer, the sort of mania around chicken shops. It was in the news, yeah. So basically chicken shops, which obviously cater for people on a low budget, have been identified as a key place where mate crime and exploitation happens. And these posters went up all over schools and like public spaces in England that warn children that there's no such thing as a free chicken. So friends of friends who buy you things often want something in return. And the government produced these things, these sort of stories about young people who got caught up in county lines and drugs and knife crime and then managed to escape that lifestyle with the help of, you know, professionals. And they printed them on chicken boxes. So when people bought fried chicken, you know, they had the government's message right in their faces. And then finally, and I'll finish after that, what we see as well with this sort of rediscovery of care is that a new image of the enemy from within is being invoked that divides working class communities that have already been disenfranchised through the kind of successive social and economic policies I've outlined. And we can see this in the ways in which now the alleged slave masters or slaveholders of the county lines drugs trade have been brought to trial. So this new piece of legislation was enacted called the Modern Slavery Act, which offers a prosecution tool for people who are said to be essentially the slave masters. And it comes with life imprisonment, so it's one, you know, one of the most severe crimes. But the way it's being used now is essentially against young people themselves who are involved in this drug trade, right, who are said to be exploiting their friends. So this is a trial I followed over 3 months this year in one of the criminal courts, where three young men in their early 20s, I think the youngest was 21, the oldest 24, were being prosecuted and found guilty of modern slavery for having exploited and trafficked a group of young people who were all aged between 16 and 19, and they're now facing life imprisonment. Okay, I think I've totally run out of time, so shall we leave conclusions?
You could leave them up there.
So I'll leave them up there.
And we'll have a couple of questions. That was fascinating, so thank you very much. Yeah. So we take a couple of specific questions for INSA now, and then we'll go to Mary. A couple of specific questions for Mary, and then open out into a more general discussion. So if there's any specific questions. Yeah, I saw that hand, yeah.
I was just wondering if you have any idea as what... why we see this shift in policy? Why did Theresa May single out modern slavery? Do you have any idea why that has been the case?
I mean, I actually think that vulnerability as a sort of policy paradigm has been on the cards for much longer, and it was already central to the new Labour government's law and order policies, but it was always about the sort of respectable, hardworking person who should be protected from crime. What's really different about this is that now people who have committed crimes, who have traditionally been seen as scroungers and as criminals, are now also being discovered as victims. And I don't know why she's doing it. I mean, there's a cynical me who says, well, it's an easy political move. Who isn't against slavery? You know, like to invoke that language in itself is, it's such a strong, powerful ideological move. I think the more difficult and fascinating question is, why has it become domesticated? And how has it become domesticated to be used as, you know, a key governing trope for working class communities? Domestic British working class communities.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, Erica?
It is quite insidious to know that it's like working class black men that are now the slave masters that we have to be in prison for this reason.
Yeah.
It's quite insidious. My question is quite simple. The chicken places, they have to agree to this? This is a very minor point, perhaps, but I'm just.
Yeah, it's
like,
a good question. Yeah, I would have thought so.
Yeah.
But I should look into it.
One thing, when I moved here a couple of years ago, I noticed the slavery discourse everywhere. And the first thing that struck me about it was like, how are they dividing slavery and not slavery? It's a way of sort of normalizing the rest of working class existence by singling out certain specific acute cases and calling it slavery. But what you're pointing out is even, the way that they use it as an excuse to police people more.
Yeah, and I mean, people I know will talk about how they're enslaved to the system through things like universal credit, the new benefit system that's extremely punitive, but obviously the language of slavery would never be used in relation to the state. It's always against the enemy from within, you know?
Absolutely fascinating, which makes me think, because we are going to carry on with questions and discussion after this in another room, which I will announce again, that we do need to ask a lot more questions, because I'm also really fascinated about how it relates to respectability, because it's almost like a shifting discourse around respectability as well. Because when you say the move from scrounging, that was like 2000, I think it began, the big scrounger discourse. It might have even been earlier. So it's been in place for a long time, so it's quite an interesting internal shift. Anyway, fascinated, it segues perfectly into thank you again. Mary Evans, who has been doing a Leverhulme project on respectability and has been studying key areas around respectability for a long time and is in the Gender Studies Department here at the LSE.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that presentation, and thank you, Bev, and everybody else for organising this today. Bev is quite right to say that I've been working on a project about respectability for some time, and part of that project has been about the ways in which and how the ideas about what a respectable woman is have changed in this country between approximately the end of the 19th century and the present day, 2019. And in the course of thinking about that idea and looking at the various material that I have found about this country and the ways in which respectable women have been presented, normalised, and made part and parcel of the culture in which we live, I've also very much come to think about the ways in which, and this is the key thing that I want to say, I think, this morning, care has, in a sense, become homeless. And it's that ideological homelessness of care that I want to make the premise of what I'm going to talk about today. Now, very briefly, in today's Guardian, to start on the 19th of November 2019, a letter from a number of very distinguished people who have worked on women and care, women and poverty, women and austerity, has pointed out that women in this country still do the majority of care work. We have to start with the acknowledgement that that is the situation, that is the literal situation that still exists. We also might point out that in the present election narratives, discussions, campaigns, there has been singularly little mention of this issue of care and care work. So let me also put that out front to you then. But then I also want to go back to 1942 and the Beveridge Report on Reconstruction and the ways in which the welfare state should be put in place after the end of the hostilities of the Second World War. As I think every feminist historian knows, everybody working in social policy knows, the Beveridge Report made it very specifically, or made the very specific point that married women had responsibilities for care, and that would keep them out of paid work and various other parts of the structures that were being put in place. But the point of that, and the point that I want to emphasise this morning, is that gave care a place. It was very specifically located with a gendered order, and it was recognised within the overall concept of welfare politics. Now, to cut a very long story short, between 1942 and 2019, all kinds of things changed, very obviously. Women started to become a very much larger section and very much more present in the paid labour market. That was both for a number of complicated reasons, emancipatory politics, the value of paid work, the need for paid work in very many contexts as well. Paid work for many working class women essential to the growing demands on household budgets. So let us not suppose that paid work was ever about, simply about female emancipation. Certainly there were arguments, there were fights about the forms that the paid work of women might take, the access that women in paid work should have to promotion, to rights, etc., etc. And all that took place, and took place, obviously, within the context of feminist politics, the struggle for the institution of payment to carers, in which people such as Hilary Land played a very important and central part. So care work became part of the commitments of the states for payments to various of its citizens. That connection was made in a way in which it had not been made before. However, something else was going on as well, besides these particular developments, these particular changes, which come out of what I think many of us would see as generally progressive narratives. What was happening in the 1980s was the development of neoliberal ideologies and policies. And part and parcel of those ideologies was, of course, the idea of what Kathleen Lynch memorably called in that decade the careless citizen. Now, the careless citizen is, I think, a hugely important person in the ways in which today's states generally, and this one in particular, think about care. And of course, in creating this ideal citizen, this master of the universe, as Gareth Stedman Jones described, the people who were both constructing and working in neoliberalism, that person had no commitments outside the commitments of paid work. He, and it was very definitely, I think, in that particular imagination, a he, had no commitments of care. So care then becomes a model of citizenship. And that, I think, is what is hugely important. It becomes part and parcel of how the state started to think of its ideal person, the person who inhabited its social space. Now, with this is the idea that as the whole concept of care started to lose its place, both in either the gendered citizen or indeed the responsibilities of the state, what started to occur is that those people on and receiving state benefits became, of course, in the decades after the 1980s, both the scroungers, the dependents, the welfare mothers, these huge categories of people who, of course, in their moral situation and in the ways in which they were talked about in the moralizing narratives of the state, were people who were not ideal citizens. They were outside the expectations of the state. They were the hangers-on, they were the underclass, they were people who were asleep when the rest of the population was on its way to work, if not actually engaged in it. So what I'm setting up is an idea that, in point of fact, what has been created in the last 50 or 60 years is a shift away from the ideals of citizenship. Now, we can see those ideals of 1942 as ways in which there was a very clear gender order, not a gendered order that everybody would want to accept. But the point is, the various changes that have taken place in the needs that women have to satisfy, as Insa pointed out, women, working class women, attempting to maintain their household budgets, attempting to keep life and soul together. Where is that space for care? So the economic and material changes have coincided with ideological changes to create a situation in which the place of care has become largely absent. Care has become homeless. is what I want to suggest this morning. And not only has literally, of course, there is a very real way, a very real way in which we can see on the streets of every city the homeless. There is no care for the homeless. But in the same way, there is no ideology that is saying that is the state responsibility for those homeless citizens, those homeless human beings. So we have a coincidence of a literal situation and an ideology, which presents us, of course, with a tremendous problem about how we are going to rethink and reattach that idea of the state responsibility for care to the situations which we now face. I think we need to notice here two things. That, first of all, I think what has happened is that the ideas about care have become very much privatised. And I mean this not just in the literal sense that care homes have been privatised, a lot of them are very inadequate for what they're supposed to do, childcare has been privatised, etc., etc., etc. But also I think the responsibility for care has been privatised in the sense that it has become the responsibility of every human citizen. So it becomes up to individual families to think about how they're going to do care. And the state, certainly in this country, has met this situation by providing schemes about childcare, woefully inadequate ones in most cases, but of course it's been failing to actually recognise and to deal with much larger questions of care, which is care for other specific categories of people, other than those of the very young and young children. I would also point out, in terms of these ideals of care and how these ideals are very much part and parcel of gender politics, the ways in which childhood and responsibility for childhood has been progressively shortened in the last decades. So at one point, responsibility for looking after children lasted very much longer in terms of welfare payments, and now it has been radically shortened, so children suddenly stop being the responsibility of the state at a much younger age. So we're producing, in all kinds of contexts, situations in which care becomes definitely a private responsibility. And yes, we can argue that in 1942 it was seen in a very gendered way as a private responsibility. But what I'm suggesting is that in 2019, the burden on the citizen, on men and women, becomes a burden in which people are being expected to be in paid work. That has become respectable for women, and this is very much part of the argument that I want to make about respectability. The respectable woman is now a woman who is in paid work. It's not just that women want to be in paid work, women have to be in paid work. It's more than that. It's an actual form of normative citizenship, that being in paid work is what constitutes your standing in the community. Now, I don't want to take this argument into arguments about who should do childcare in the family, should men do more childcare, etc., etc. But where I want to take the argument, and this is where I want to conclude because I'm probably running out of time, is with the idea, which was very much part of what Bev said and of the previous speaker. And the idea is that care and the need for care is a basic human condition. And that until care is actually recognised in that way, there will be very little, I think, substantial or effective ways in which we can deal with problems of an older population, the needs of every adult citizen to be in hard work, to be in paid work, the needs to maintain households, the needs to contribute to household budgets. Until we can actually get our heads to the point of saying, okay, care is something which is part of the human condition, and it impacts on human beings in ways which have to be recognised by the state. So it's not just about the fragmented schemes of extending help in particular situations. It's not just about saying, okay, let's argue about when you have to pay for care for old people, who contributes to care for all kinds of other care that might be necessary over the life cycle. These arguments are important. They have to be done in ways which make these systems work. But fundamental to this is, I think, going back to that recognition that every community, every society has needs for care, and that those have to have a place. They have to be ideologically placed within the context of state politics. And until that can be recognised and placed, I think care is going to, like many of those people who are the victims of the lack of care, is going to remain homeless. So thank you. That's my welcome.